Hello, 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 and welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. I have such a special guest for you today, and that is the, shall we say, the British rights campaigner, our British native rights campaigner, Miss Katie Fanning. And while I sign into the old entropy, I'm going to ask Katie to introduce herself. So, Katie, over to you.
Hi, I'm Bubba Kate Paris, otherwise known as Katie Fanning. Some of you might know me on Telegram as Paris. I've been introduced as a British rights campaigner. I'm a white Indigenous rights campaigner for the Indigenous white populations of Great Britain, and I'm currently setting up a community interest company called the White Indigenous Rights Alliance, and also suing my former university for their discrimination against white students, along with other projects. I think this evening they'll want to ask a few questions about my background, political history, my case against my university, the progress of that so far, what it's like trying to study in an anti-white Marxist environment, and what it's like being a litigant in person within our... Okay.
Cheers, everybody. Cheers. Cheers, Katie. Cheers, Scapegoat. Cheers, Jew A.B. Luce. Cheers, Troll with Purpose. Cheers, Bacon Quagga. Cheers, everybody. Hurligan Gurligan, Capis, Saludo, Skull, Proust, and all that. And welcome to this edition of Slander, Slandervar. She has great hair, says Carlotta. Yes, she does. Very, very, very brown, long. Welcome to this edition of the Jolly Heretic. We are, of course, an online public house that meets on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, in which we discuss the kind of based science which is increasing. Expunged from our woke joke universities, and which we also meet dissident scientists and dissident people in general. And we have Charles Yamaskudo, Skull, Simon Persson. I'm on IPA Green King. She's chat bad, so she's well fitted. Yes, I like to get quality barmaids here at the Jolly Heretic. So cheers, everybody, and welcome to Jolly Heretic, and if you blah 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 and all this. And so today we're speaking with Miss Katie Fanning. So we'll be talking about her Hergen Gerligan, Yuhamarkala, and our resident poet at the Jolly Heretic has written a poem for today's occasion. We have a resident poet at the Jolly Heretic, and he says, our glamorous guest here tonight stands up for the right to be white, a most noble cause, deserving applause. Let's hope she continues the fight. So thank you very much, Mr. Quinn, once again for your excellent poem. So if you have any questions for Katie on the issue of her campaign against her university and all this, and her campaign for white rights in the UK, then do send them in and on the old entropy, the link's on the screen, or on YouTube, and we will, of course, answer them today. So tell me then, how did you how did you get into all this all this dissident stuff, and what's your story, as it were? How did you get to this point?
So I first became involved in politics, or interested in politics, in sort of 2010-2012, but I was busy at work, and then I broke my leg, and I'd actually recently learned about UKIP within that year. And that was in 2013, and ended up joining the UK Independence Party and was a member of that for some time whilst we were fighting our way outside of the EU. Took part in the referendum, briefly did a stint within the Tories in their Make Brexit Happen campaign, but was always known as somebody who was a little bit outspoken and a little bit too far to the right for many of these organisations. And I had enough of holding my tongue, although the plan was to go off and go get an education and retrain in law so that I could be of more use in the way of helping our people overcome the challenges that we face in society. But then when I went to university, I quickly found that it was completely intolerable, the level of anti-whiteness and the propaganda that we had to endure, and the obvious discrimination in the way of opportunity, in placement, in service, in preference. It was just in every manner, in every regard, the non-white students of foreign origin were given special privileges and preference over the Indigenous populations, who are deemed to be privileged regardless of their backgrounds, and not given the same sort of opportunities. So that
was
when...
Can you give me some examples? So you were at the... I'm allowed to say what university it is, right?
That's not... Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So you were at the open... You for various reasons we'll perhaps look at later. You were an adult when you started your degree. You were open university, and you were doing law. Mm-hmm. So what was it that was the... What were you noticing then that was discriminatory against white undergraduates or white students?
So when I entered, it was Black History Month, I think, as it is right now. So a lot of the Afrocentric propaganda is around how whites are responsible for all of the world's ills. But obviously, there is a concentration on the term whiteness within Black History Month and blaming whiteness for many of the negative things that have happened to Black people or are supposed to be happening to Black people within our societies today. There were also things like bursary schemes and opportunities to meet future employers for internships and job placements that were only open to Black and ethnic minorities. Everything that I read that was to do with white people and the attributes of the white race was negative and derogatory and calling for our, well, abolishment, which the only way you could abolish the attributes of the white race is by, well, exterminating us. And this is something that seems to be promoted within our universities, along with statements of support for the Black Lives Matter terrorist organization, which I found appalling considering their lengthy list of crimes that they've committed. So
what you're saying is, my understanding, I did work experience as a solicitor when I was 15, and I found it so boring that I decided that I didn't want to be a solicitor anymore. So I didn't do the sensible thing of doing a law degree. I did a theology degree, which is not quite so practically useful. Indeed, one of the solicitors I was with was telling me how boring it was, and he was evidently right. I mean, it's interesting going to Crown Court and whatever. That's interesting, but even a barrister was telling me, "Look, this is not." Anyway, the point is that it's a very competitive to become a lawyer. A lot of people do law degrees. There's far too many people with law degrees, and so it's very difficult to get the edge, as it were. How you get the edge is either having a law degree from somewhere really, really good, or having a first-class law degree, or whatever. So you're saying that white people it was rendered more difficult for them to have the edge. Is that what you mean?
Yes, definitely. Those opportunities were certainly being ring-fenced for Black and ethnic minorities. And if you actually look at the list of names of people who were called to the bar over recent years, you will notice that they're not names of people of white indigenous descent. And this is because it's been considered that the juries, the judiciary and people that work within law are too white, and this that they need more diversity. In fact, I've been told by one barrister that when they make them swear oaths now to be champions of diversity and equality. I mean, even within the course materials when I was studying law, one of the first questions that was posed to us was, how important is it that we increase diversity within the judges of this country? Because they were trying to claim that Black and ethnic minorities are treated less leniently for the same crimes as whites, when the opposite is actually true. And in the sentencing guidelines that were released in 2017, it even states that Black and ethnic minorities should be treated more leniently than white people who commit the same or similar crimes on the basis of they've had to deal with systemic oppression throughout their lifetime. And that might have contributed to the way that they've decided to go ahead with their lives, in particular committing certain offences.
But what about the idea that that the legal profession is too posh and too upper class and too public school, and that therefore there needs to be help for working class people whose parents don't have degrees, whatever, to get into? Was there any help in that? I mean, you told me that's the kind of background you were from. Was there any help in that regard for working class people?
No. I raised this with the Open University. I presented evidence and data that goes back to 2007, actually, and consistently since that time. The white indigenous populations from disadvantaged backgrounds, people on free school meals, people whose parents didn't go on to university, are actually having the lowest participation and attainment rates in higher education. They are the least likely to apply to or to be accepted into university. The white indigenous population, particularly boys from the white working class, are the ones that are suffering the most. And yet there are no initiatives to increase participation in higher education for boys. In fact, actually, there are a few universities that started to adopt some policies for specifically boys from the white working class to increase their participation. But most universities, with the rampant anti-white agenda, which they call anti-racism, throughout our education system at this time, they don't feel that anybody, regardless of their socio or economic backgrounds, should be given any sort of opportunity to overcome those challenges if they're white. Because it doesn't matter if you're extremely poor, that you've come from poverty, or if you've come from care. If you're white, you're deemed to be privileged and part of this privileged class. And therefore, you must not even complain that you're not given the same opportunities. Otherwise, you are deemed a racist.
What about being a woman? Are they trying? Do they? Is there help for you? You turned up as a woman. Is there any help for people that are women? Or is it, you have to be ethnic minority woman?
No. I think there probably are some sort of feminist things going on in there. But at this time, with the way that education is going, I mean, women are actually, I think females now make up something like 60% of students. You know, females are going on to university in much higher numbers than men are. So I don't think that's an area where they thought we could get away with more positive discrimination.
Oh, I see what you mean. No, yes, that's right. Really, we need to have positive discrimination in favor of men,
yes.
and that would never do. I mean, okay. And so, how was this case then that you brought against the university and Open University, and how has this panned out?
Oh, it's currently in motion. So I have advanced several legal claims against my former university, the Open University. Most of them are underneath the Equality Act of 2010. So there are claims for direct discrimination in regards to things like the bursary schemes that were only open to Black and ethnic minorities, and opportunities and jobs that were only advertised for Black and ethnic minorities, things like internships that you need to become fully qualified that were only for Black and ethnic minorities. Then there are two claims of direct discrimination of philosophical and factual beliefs under the Granger versus Nicholson case law. One of them is in relation to systemic discrimination against the white indigenous population. And the other is being disciplined for calling Black Lives Matter a terrorist organization. Then there are also...
How are you disciplined for that factual statement?
I was subjected to a formal disciplinary for calling Black Lives Matter a terrorist organization. There was a forum with an awful lot of Afrocentric propaganda, and I simply stated underneath it that I thought that this left-wing propaganda was unnecessary and divisive on an introductory law forum for new students. That's all I said. I just said the left-wing propaganda is a bit unnecessary and divisive. And before you knew it, you know, the left-wing students have come in, they doxed me, they started putting personal information on there, they started putting it onto Twitter. And this was purely just from one comment, oh, look at these photographs, who she's been photographed with. I raised my concerns with the university after seeing this, because I thought, well, you could engage in, you know, a decent debate or conversation of whether you think it's left-wing propaganda or not. A number of students obviously did agree with me. So I raised my concerns about the malicious publication of my personal information onto public domains by the students to the university, along with my concerns about the, well, what I call Afrocentric anti-white propaganda, the statements of support for what is a terrorist organization, Black Lives Matter, my awareness since joining of the opportunities, like I say, bursary schemes and opportunities to meet employers that were only open to Black and ethnic minorities, and yeah, stated that there might be people from the white indigenous population, especially going to the Open University, which is supposed to be open to all regardless of background. I mean, that's what they're supposed to pride themselves on. And I said, do you not think that there might be white people from disadvantaged backgrounds that should also be given these opportunities, you know, to progress and actually secure some sort of employment at the end of their education? And they turned around to me and said, well, no, we don't believe that there needs to be any initiatives for white people, and we're going to review what was said on this forum. Now, I was completely reasonable on this forum, and other people were certainly not. And they came back and they said they wanted to discipline me, but yet they didn't have a reason. So I told them.
It sounds a bit sort of S&M. I mean,
I asked them, right, okay, well, if you're going to subject me to a disciplinary, you've actually got to tell me what it's for. And I now know, because I did a subject access request and I've seen their emails, they weren't even sure what they were disciplining me for. They were doing it because of wrongthink originally, and then decided it was because I might upset people by calling Black Lives Matter a terrorist organization.
I was disciplined when I was an undergraduate for calling a porter at Collingwood College. I called him ignorant. I said, you're very ignorant. And because he came in and he said, all right, everyone out, everyone's not in Collingwood, get out. It's exam time, you gotta be here, get out. And I was a bit drunk, and I said, I'm protested and said he was ignorant. And he complained to the master of the college, who was a woman. And she then complained to the master of my college. And then I had to go and see the master of Collingwood College, who was this woman in her 60s called Dr. Jane Taylor. And she just said to me, Mr. Dutton, you must understand that some of my porters, you know, they were down the pit at 14. And when they see people like you that talk like you and dress like you and you're coming in here, the great and the good, I just felt that word ignorant was perhaps ill-advised. And I said, okay, I'm sorry. I said, good. And then for the rest of the meeting, which went on for half an hour, then she just asked me about my PhD research that I was going to do. So I was expecting a real bollocking. She's very clever. Anyway, look, moving on to your... yes, so you Yes. So you and so then tell me about this this court case. Then how's that? It's developed from there. So you took them to court for this, defending yourself. You're representing yourself.
I am. I'm a litigant in person. So
isn't that you're not meant to do that? Isn't that the one piece of advice that all lawyers give is just don't do that?
Of course, they're going to give you that advice. They don't want people being able to independently access their legal rights. My goodness, if people start being able to navigate the legal system independently, they're not going to be able to charge people extortionate amounts for things like a letter anymore, are they? So, yeah, no, the system doesn't like people that end up navigating the system of their own accord, but it's becoming a lot more common due to the cuts in legal aid. You see, we've got to funnel that money towards the illegal immigrants fighting deportation. So any Indigenous people wanting to fight civil cases, they can't get any legal aid in this country, especially if you're white. So my choice was, letting them get away with it or representing myself. And I thought, you know what, I can do this. And even if I lose, it's not like it's really going to harm me in any way. And for me, it's great practice. I mean, before you were talking about, you know, law being very competitive. I mean, I'm not necessarily doing this for a career. I'm doing this because my end goal is to take our governments and other people who are complicit, past and present, to international courts of law for their acts of genocide against our people. I'm not doing this to get something else out of it. I'm doing this for justice. That's why I'm getting this law degree. No other reason. I think people don't understand that either. And I don't think the legal schools understood this. But I'm not going to sit by and allow people to treat me and other white people as second-class citizens in my own country and then victimize me by sending the police to my house to ask me why I don't like Black Lives Matter. I'm not going to
talk. What happened? Did they do that? Did they do that?
Yeah, they sent the police to my house. It was 8:15 in the morning. Bang, bang, bang. I was expecting a parcel, so I'm still in my pajamas.
No student should be awake at 8:15 in the morning.
Yeah, well, I sleep 4 hours on average each evening, so I can go to sleep at 1 and I could be up at like 5, 6. That's quite normal for me. So, you know, I'm awake. And anyway, they came to my door and they knocked on and these male officers, a couple of them are like in uniform and two of them aren't. And I said, what are you doing here? And they were like, well, we're here on behalf of your university to ask you why you don't like Black Lives Matter. And at that point, I was just like, right, do you have a warrant? No, we'll get the fuck off my property or I'm going to sue you for trespass. I was absolutely fuming. And I'd given the university lots of opportunities, right, to deal with my complaints and concerns regarding their harassment of white students by creating a degrading, hostile and derogatory environment for white students to actually try and study in by constantly promoting anti-white propaganda, even when it's really not even relevant to our course materials. It's just there constantly. I thought, no, because nobody else is going to do it. No barrister, no solicitor is going to take something like this on. And I thought, you know what? Someone needs to test this. I'm going to access my own legal rights. I'll teach myself the civil procedure rules. I'll learn how to do all the processing of the forms. I will learn the law. I will access the case law and I will bring these claims forward. They tried to get my claims thrown out. And what happened was in that hearing, the defense got thrown out. Their defense that their professional barristers put together, that got thrown out by the judge. And yet the majority of my claims still stand. And they broke multiple civil procedure rules, by the way. That's all in the public domain now because it's, you know, was in that hearing. And yet, you know, I can't understand how legal professionals who can make so many mistakes and then a litigant in person doing all the work on her own has only made one, which was there wasn't a formal letter before claim. And that was mostly due to the people that were formally representing me not having done that and me having a very limited time after Crowd Justice refused to allow my campaign forward, because originally I was going to raise money through Crowd Justice and get some independent legal advisors. Somebody actually offered to take it on if I could pay them, but Crowd Justice did not want to approve my campaign, most likely because I was going to end up fighting for the rights of white people. So I've decided to stick two fingers up.
Do you have any barristers on the QT that are helping you out?
I've not really had that much advice. I had a little bit of advice in the beginning stages, which was greatly appreciated. And trying to come by advice, you know, pro bono advice is quite difficult. You can get advice on procedures, basically. And that's only if you figure out what forms you've got to use. And most of it's done by people with not that great legal expertise. I would say one of the easiest places to get information from, but again, it's hit and miss whether you can get an appointment, is, why have they gone out of my head now? They're the same people that you go to, Citizens Advice, that's them. But there are people who are sympathetic, who are, understanding of what's going on. But I want to use it as a learning experience anyway. I mean, it's fantastic to learn how the court works, how I file all of these documents, how they're supposed to be presented, what are the civil procedure rules that govern how these documents are supposed to be put together. Mm. It's all going to be very good practice for trying to hold our genocidal government to account in future. So
it sounds, I hope that this goes well for you. It would be an excellent test case. Now, the other thing, of course, that people will wonder about, and we talked about this before the show, and I'm slightly concerned about raising it, but you said I could, so I will. Which is, can you expand on why it was that your education was delayed in this way?
Well, I don't think it's much of a secret. I try to not make it like a core part of my identity because I don't want to be known as the victim girl. But I was, you know, one of the victims of the Muslim paedophile rapist gangs. And because of this, I never finished my GCSEs. Nobody cared where I was, not my family, not the local authority. Nobody reported me missing. I just fell through the cracks. So I wasn't present to take my GCSEs. And then I went off and I did, you know, things that you didn't need qualifications to enter into education, like hairdressing, went off into working in bars and nightclubs and in all the student places in the city that I lived in. And then I got more serious in my early 20s and started doing sales, you know, telesales. I was selling.
Excuse my ignorance. And if I cross the line at any point, there's something you don't want to talk about, then fine. But how does this falling through the cracks happen? I mean, what was I was when this came to light in Oulu, this grooming thing, I thought to myself, look, I would be horrified. I would say to my daughter, you know, what are you playing at? Don't go and hang around the shopping mall here in Oulu with the Iraqi men. And were your parents? Why would they not aware of what was going on?
I don't think they were fully aware of what was going on at the time. I mean, I was unlucky, really, in the way that I ended up in the hands of these people, because I lived in quite a small town in a rural area, and it was quite normal for young people there to take on jobs. I mean, I'd already worked in like doing paper rounds and such, but a number of friends of mine worked in things like chip shops and Chinese restaurants that, you know, were in the town center. So I went looking for a job and ended up working in an Indian restaurant. And this is where I met the guy that trafficked me. He owned this Indian restaurant. And, you know, while I was working there, he befriended me, and he actually befriended my stepdad and became quite good friends with him as well. I mean, they would sit at the bar and talk to each other. And obviously the process of grooming kind of sets in. They start to make you believe that they really care about you, that they see you as an adult. You drink and smoke with them. You know, I'm obviously getting my wages from them. They treat me like an adult. And then, you know,
How old were you?
Well, it started at 13. And by 14, I was, you know, I started playing up at school. I was quite intelligent, but, you know, school I found quite boring. And because of what was going on outside of school, you know, I was arriving with cuts and bruises and looking a mess and looking, you know, out of it. and obviously agitated, kicking off with the staff at times being quite belligerent. I mean, eventually expelled for persistent defiant behaviour and inspiring rebellious behaviour in others. And after
how did you inspire rebellious behaviour in others?
Oh, I had a protest. It was all about having to wear blazers in summer, and we refused to go into class. And then these girls as well. I ended up having a fight with two girls and ended up in hospital. It was not, it just wasn't very good. My behaviour wasn't very good at that time. So, you know, but it's understandable. You're young, you're immature, you're, you know, being subject to quite horrific crimes and you don't know what to do about it. And once I got expelled from school, my mother didn't really care where I was. So I could go missing for weeks, a month on end. And the school, I wasn't at school, so there was nobody to report me missing. The
local why did your mother not care where you were?
She just didn't care. And in fact, you know, later on when I actually reported it to the police, my mother was incredibly angry at me for doing so, because she's more interested in looking like a good parent than actually being one. And at that time, I still had siblings. If you're going to ask questions that are going to be difficult and then cut me off, I probably won't continue with the interview.
Sorry, I'm so sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. There's a lag. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to be rude. Sorry, carry on.
So, where were we up to?
Siblings, you said, the word siblings.
Yeah, so I had a number of siblings, and I think my mother just thought, well, we can't control her, and I'd rather not have the embarrassment of police and social workers and them having, you know, a big deep dive into our family. So my mother never reported me missing because she didn't want to look like a bad mother. She didn't want the neighbours seeing police and other things coming to the door. In fact, when I ended up reporting the crimes later on in life, she blamed me, saying that it was my fault for being a promiscuous child and that I brought it on myself, and that reporting it had brought her into shame. So we don't talk anymore, obviously.
No, I can see that it sounds rather difficult. And your father was out of the picture.
My father lived in a different area. He's obviously he's learnt about it now, and there's been some talks, and there's a lot of forgiveness there. I get on very well with my father and his side of the family. It's just you know, I'm not going to be able to forgive somebody that blames their own daughter for those sorts of things and refuse to report them missing just to, like, save her own reputation. And unfortunately, I think that is something that might have happened to a lot of girls that aren't typically from, because I didn't originally come from what you call a working class background. Well, it was originally, but my mother and stepfather had good jobs and moved us off to quite a nice area where you wouldn't expect this grooming to happen. People wouldn't expect it to happen in these places, but it's just endemic throughout these foreign origin people.
Okay, well, the only other thing I was going to ask you about then was involved with UKIP. So how did you get involved with UKIP and why?
Well, I broke my leg in, I think it was 2013. So I couldn't do my job any longer. And I was stuck in a wheelchair with plaster casts and that sort of thing. So I spent a lot more time on the internet, and I decided to make the leap from just observing politics to getting involved. And I think it was in 2014, there was a local election, and I wanted to vote for my local UKIP candidate and found that they weren't on the ballot. So then I rang the UKIP head office and I found out there was a local branch, but quite far away. And I turned up actually about a week after they'd taken the temporary pins out my leg. So I turned up wet, disheveled, because I'd had to come on multiple forms of public transport. The staples holding my wound together on my leg had basically strained, and there was like blood on my tights and all sorts. It was awful. But from that meeting, I then helped to set up the local branch with a few other members, and that became highly successful. Then I ran one of the general election campaigns here in Manchester, where we increased our vote share quite a lot. I stood myself as a candidate in a few local elections. I ended up serving on their National Executive Committee. I was voted onto that in 2016 and was a member of their board of directors and the NEC from 2016 to mid-2019, when the purge of the people who were too far right came. So it was an interesting time, and I'm very proud of them bringing about the referendum and securing that referendum. It's just a shame that what we were thinking that it was going to achieve hasn't been achieved. It hasn't secured our borders. We haven't got back our sovereignty. It's done nothing about the UN and the UN Migration Pact. So although there has been a slight improvement, and I think it really pissed off the globalists, my time in UKIP was mostly enjoyable, and it gave me a good insight into party politics, and some great contacts along the way as well.
Yes, I've had some UKIP people on here. I had Godfrey Bloom on the Jolly Heretic.
He's entertaining.
I'm having someone that used to be involved in UKIP on next week, so why do you think it is that? I mean, why did Farage? I couldn't understand it. Why Farage rejected UKIP? Why did? Is he just a sort of Machiavellian? That like, what was the? Why did he have to do that? This idea that it's become too far right. He chose to stop being the leader for his own reasons. They had this fiasco where they kept electing. They elected this woman, and then she didn't want to do it, and then they elected somebody else. And why do you think that? Why did these problems happen with UKIP? You think?
Right. Well, Nigel Farage should not have stood down until really, you know, it had been the point where everything had been agreed and signed, and we'd left the EU. But I think after many years of campaigning to get the referendum, then fighting that referendum, he thought that he could have a bit of a break and maybe do more media work than political work, or maybe just concentrate on being in the European Union, because he was still going to be keeping his MEP seat for a while. But, you know, being leader of a political party with the kind of presence and profile that Nigel Farage has, I think it just became a bit exhausting and he wanted a break. And I don't think he realised that, you know, there was going to be issues when you take somebody out as important as Farage when there's a power vacuum. So what happened as soon as Farage left was there were many factions that formed within UKIP who preferred certain peoples that had ideologies that were more suited towards their own, whereas previously we'd all been focused on leaving the European Union. There was people like myself that wanted to nudge UKIP more towards, you know, talking about the Muslim paedophile rapist gangs and demographic change and, you know, the wider global impacts of certain Marxist institutions like the UN, for example. But, you know, there were other people that thought that that was too far right. So there was many different fractions. And obviously we had Diane, and then Diane stood down because she didn't like being leader. And then we had Henry, and we kicked Henry out. And then we had Gerard Batten, and Gerard became too friendly with Tommy. And then everybody started playing games, trying to sabotage everyone. And it just turned into an absolute nightmare near the end. I mean, at least I managed to get Gerard Batten in, and they started talking about Muslim paedophile rapist gangs and making people more aware of these things. But I don't think that all the infighting and such did UKIP much favours.
I also have Neil Hamilton on here. He's the leader of UKIP, isn't he? Yes, Neil Hamilton's drunk.
Is he? Yes, he is now, isn't he? I saw a picture that somebody shared with me on WhatsApp recently of their Southeast Conference.
So, yeah, it seems to be kind of winding up. Okay, we're about halfway through. So for those of you that are new to the Jolly Heretic, hello. Welcome to the Jolly Heretic. We are an online public house that meets on Mondays and Thursdays at 7 p.m. UK time, 2 p.m. New York, in which we discuss based science and based research of all kinds, which is increasingly expunged from our woke joke universities. And on Monday, it's normally me on my own answering your various intelligent questions, which you can send in on the link below, and I will research them and you will receive an answer within a week or so. Exception being this week, because I shall be at the traditional Britain Group conference at the weekend, and then I'll be in London, and so I won't be back on Monday. And on Thursdays, we have a jolly interesting guest, and we seem to have a very interesting guest today, who has told us about some fascinating stuff. She calls herself Bubba. Where does this Katie Fanning? Why does she call? What's this book? This Bubba thing? Where's that?
Most of my social media profiles, if you can still find them, I have a censored Telegram channel called Bubba Kate versus the State. There is also a Facebook channel still. I have somebody else running it called Bubba Kate versus the State. And it's the same with YouTube. The idea was, upon the creation of these, because I kept getting cancelled from various platforms, was that I was going to talk about certain subjects. So let's say I wanted to talk about the anti-white rampant Marxist agenda throughout our education system. I would call it Bubba Kate versus the State of Marxist Education. Or if I was talking about the Home Office, Bubba Kate versus the State of the Home Office. Or it might be Bubba Kate versus the, and eventually it will be Bubba Kate versus the State, because I will be taking, as I say, people who are guilty of acts of genocide against our Indigenous populations to be accountable for their crimes in courts of law. So that's the end goal with it. And that's why it's called Bubba Kate versus the State.
It's good that Kate rhymes with state. That's good. It's good.
It
good.
Was useful.
Useful. So, anyway, if you have any questions for Katie Fanning, Bubba Kate, on the issues we've been talking about, which is the Muslim grooming issue and her legal case against the Open University for anti-white discrimination, and also UKIP, she was involved, then do send them in, and we will, of course, answer them today. I was going to say something. Hang on, there was something important I was going to say. Oh, yes. This surname, Fanning, very unusual. Where's it from?
I believe it's an old English name originally. I thought it might be from Ireland, but no, when I looked it up online, and it goes back in England quite some time. So,
well, like Fenning, from a fen.
Fenning. It was Fenning at one point.
Oh, I see. Oh, right. Yeah, that would make sense. Excellent. Okay, so I'm now going to turn to the various questions that you have kindly sent in. Hang on, what's going on here? There we go. Yeah, right. Yes. Yes, good. Okay, so the first question is from Yao Escudo, and she says, where do you see anti-white policies in the UK in 20 years, in 20 years 50, or 50 years? Do you see a future where the whites aren't discriminated against? I feel like every year that goes by, extreme violence becomes more likely.
Yes, I mean, if you look at the stages of genocide and ethnic cleansing, there are different steps. They don't always come in exactly the same order, but these stages are usually present before there is a violent genocide. And what they're doing at the moment with their mass targeted campaign against white people and whiteness, one by bringing over peoples of foreign origin to make us a vulnerable persecuted minority in our own lands, but then also teaching the children and these people that the only way they can be free of racism and oppression is by abolishing white people, is trying to set a climate that's ripe for violent genocide. So I don't believe in 50 years' time that there will be such thing as anti-white policies, because either there will be no more people of foreign origin in Britain, or there will be no more white people.
Or, well, there'd be no Britain.
It'd be primitives living in the ashes of what our ancestors once built.
Yes, and it'll break up. That's what happens in the winter of civilization. I mean, you're already getting it, I think, in places like Bradford and Leicester. You've got basically areas that are not fully under control of the state. That's what you get. And that's like in like parts of like Free Derry. If you've ever been there, you go in a big sign saying Free Derry, and this is IRA that run this place. And so you just get things like that. And that's what's been happening in Leicester. It's a sort of gang warfare. Yeah, okay. The next question comes from, who's this then? Yes. From Sin Wolf, and he says, more an observation that university law faculties are highly subverted by the revolutionary left in the 70s. My dad observed this firsthand at the LSE. Also, CRT started out as critical legal studies. Would you like to comment on that?
I didn't know that, actually. I'm going to look that up after we get off this stream. Critical legal studies. See, I did actually think that studying law would have a lot less of this nonsense within it, because I thought it would be very matter of fact. It would be based upon case law. You know, that there wouldn't be much room for the propaganda within the course materials. And I was very wrong. But I will look that up, critical law theory. Because now they've just changed the name of critical race theory to anti-racism, branding it under a different name.
Under a name you can't argue with. So
if you're not an anti-racist, which means you must be a racist, therefore you're the worst thing to ever exist. You know, you must
it's
be. Quite,
it's brilliant. That's very. It's
very clever. Very clever.
Just call it anti-racism. Just call it anti-racism. So we you'd have to rebrand nationalism. Not wanting to genocide white people. That would be all of that.
Yes.
Not wanting to rape white teenagers. We are the not wanting to rape white teenagers party. Are you against us? Why are you against us? That would be a good idea. Yes, and the other thing that the gentleman said about the law, this is not the problem with law, though, that law, you have the, what's it called, the positivist dimension and the idealistic dimension. And there's this balance between the two. If you have just positivism, it's just the letter of the law, then somebody could, I don't know, murder somebody, make someone change their will, murder somebody, and then profit from the crime. So you have to have a legal principle that can't happen. You can't profit from your own crime. So you get this balance between legal principle, which says a certain thing, and the letter of the law. And I would assume that what you're getting is a movement away from the letter of the law and towards idealism. Is that...
Yes. Well, I think the idealism unfortunately, will go on to shape what is the letter of the law. I mean, we have a number of very Marxist pieces of legislation, one of which I'm actually using against the Marxists themselves, like the Equality Act of 2010, which doesn't really implement equality because it gives people a free pass to discriminate against white people if they believe that it's proportionate to achieve a legitimate aim. I mean, it's a means of being able to transfer the wealth and power of the indigenous population over to these people of foreign origin in the name of equality.
Yes, and I think also it's a particularly dangerous precedent. There seems to be this, once you say that, like, the Home Secretary, first of all, it was the Home Secretary is a woman. There's been woman Home Secretaries for ages. And it's almost like now it would be wrong to appoint a man as Home Secretary. And now the last two Home Secretaries have been ethnic minority women. And so it strikes me that once that precedent is set, then it becomes almost, oh, we better appoint another ethnic minority or another woman as Home Secretary, another ethnic minority woman. And so there'll never be a male white Home Secretary ever again. So you get these, and that then has impacts on the legal system. I'm concerned about that this Conservative government is...
The Home Office should be a major concern to the white Indigenous population. I mean, I've yet to really be looking deeply into our new Home Secretary, but Priti Patel was terrible. I mean, she actually openly stated in Parliament that she would be implementing anti-white policies. I mean, she didn't say it like that, but she said there are too many white faces in the Home Office, and therefore she was going to be implementing mentorship schemes and recruitment policies that would change that somewhat. And now, if you've seen the recent pictures of the top tier of the Home Office, I don't think there are actually any white men there. And this is the highest office in our land that deals with immigration and crime, and yet there are no Indigenous white men who seem to be in positions of any sort of power and authority within it. In fact, there was a court case about two years ago, where a gentleman in the Home Office was suing Priti Patel and the Home Office because he was being paid considerably less than a black woman doing exactly the same role at the Home Office was being paid. So he wanted to sue, but somehow he'd not read the small print inside his employment contract, which basically stated that he had agreed to that. So they got around it somehow, but they're actually paying black women more than they will white men at the Home Office. I will find the case for you in a...
Because they bring diversity. So
diversity, you know, that's the most important thing. It's the same with like our military and our intelligence services. Never mind, you know, the risks to our national security. Having black and brown faces there is more important.
I love the way that at the Queen's funeral, somebody obviously thought to themselves, there aren't any very overweight black women that are going to be speaking at this funeral. We need to find a very overweight black priest. It's fundamental. Go and look for one. There's bound to be one. And they found one, and they dressed her up in a big black cape, and they brought her in just so there could be a very fat black lady speaking.
You've got to have diversity tokens. It's like the rules now. I mean, after the royal family got berated for, you know, Prince Philip's funeral, where they were complaining it was too white. Why were all the people there white? And it's like, because the royal family are white and it's COVID right now, so it's not going to have a big audience now, is it? But they did complain at the time that it was a bit too white for them. I'm going to have to get up for 2 seconds just to let my cat out, because otherwise she's going to start going.
I have that problem too. Yeah, I have.
They're demanding creatures, aren't they?
Yeah, I'll just go and see if my cat's about. Just a second.
We're both running off for a cat check. Okay. Right, put in. We're back.
No, Margaret is not there, chaps. Margaret is, I don't know, she's very busy at the moment. It's getting dark here, and she's patrolling her territory. Margaret is, I have a 15-year-old black and white pussycat called Margaret. And
Does she do cameo appearances every now and then?
She does, yeah. She's been on the Jolly Heretic many times. Some people have actually sent in super chats to simp bucks for Margaret. And she's very happy about that. What we on? Yes, good. Yes. So is it completely? I'm just thinking about cats now. That's no good. It's completely messed up the rhythm of my the flow of my my thought. What was the question? It was this revolutionary left. We were talking about the cabinet and I was just going to say that we've got viewers here from all over the world, and a lot of those viewers are from ethno nations, and you will all agree that if you meet somebody of your own group, there is an immediate bond by virtue of the fact that you have the same ancestors. You know, your ancestors came over with the Saxons. You're the same people. You're an extended genetic family. Two average English people are 12th cousins. Myself and Katie are probably at worst have a common ancestor in the 1500s. Now, and that is not, that's important, because it's one people engaging in a story across time, and you can have a certain sympathy for somebody who is part of your family. And what we're being told is no, these are completely different. They have no relationship with us, and they're running the country. So it's almost like the Dane law or something.
It's very odd. I mean, this must be the first time in history that without a actual physical war taking place, that an invasion, occupation, and then governance of a nation has been overtaken by people of foreign origin in the matter of a few short decades. I mean, to the extent where we're nearly a vulnerable, persecuted minority. I mean, we had an Indian and an African running for prime minister. I mean, Kemi Badenoch, she's born and educated in Nigeria. She has no British lineage, and yet she's running for prime minister of our country. Why? Why do people think that this is acceptable? Rishi Sunak, why is he even allowed to vote in our elections? Never mind actually become a politician in our country. I mean, you wouldn't see English people, you know, moving to India and then suddenly becoming Indian prime minister. You wouldn't have white people moving to Nigeria and suddenly becoming, you know, government ministers there. It's only in white countries.
That's the interesting thing, that in India you did. You had Sonia Gandhi, who was Italian, and she was the leader of the Congress Party. This is about 17 years ago. And she was the leader of the Congress Party, which is the equivalent of the leftist party. And they won the election. She was the leader of the Congress Party. Ergo, she was become prime minister. And there was such a backlash against this, with the opposition saying it's a national disgrace. And of course, Sonia Gandhi's husband was assassinated. And so she was sufficiently concerned about assassination that she said, my inner voice tells me not to become prime minister. And so instead, it was this Sikh guy that became prime minister, but she kind of pulled the strings. But that can happen. But she was unique. She was the only one. She's the only white person in the Indian Parliament. She was just
her. It'd be very odd in any non-white countries for people of foreign origin to then become, you know, they're in governance. Whereas in the United Kingdom, this is actually promoted as something that's beneficial. Oh, look at the diversity. You have to at least have been born in the United States. But here in the United Kingdom, I mean, you could have been born in Nigeria. You could have been born in Pakistan. I mean, I saw people running in local elections that couldn't even speak English.
It's the number of them. So I can think of examples where there's one unique, amazing, charismatic person. Like, what was that guy called in Chile? Was it Fujimori? And he was president of Chile. He was Japanese ancestry. But it's the fact that it's all of the major officers.
I've not heard of him. I'm hearing a few things. I'm thinking I should have really brought a little notebook.
It was Fujimori. He was about 20 years ago. He was president of Chile,
and was Japanese.
He's Japanese, yeah. I think it was Chile. It was certainly a South American country. Peru. Big scary Steve is correcting me. Alberto Fujimori, and he was president of Peru, and he was Japanese.
Difference with these, this woman in India and this gentleman in Chile, is that they would have been still a definite minority within those countries. They weren't having mass influxes of Italians that were collectivizing for their own interests within India, were they? I mean, it's not like you had a mass influx of Japanese that were then collectivizing in that country, in Chile, for their own interests. But we do have mass influx of Nigerians, of Pakistanis, of Arabs, of lots of people of foreign origin from other continents that come here mostly.
Are you ready for the future of the West?